Brevity codes are designed to convey complex information with a few words or codes. Think of it as a short hack to key information. On this podcast, it's about sharing insights, success stories, and personal journeys across a broad spectrum of disciplines. Welcome to the Brevity Code. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Brevity Code. Today I'm joined by my friend, LeJean Boudreau. He is a U.S. pararescue and combat rescue officer. Welcome to the show.
Hey, what's up? Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
Dude, always good. I mean, we're buddies, so this is, it's kind of a cool thing. We get to kind of do something with a microphone in front of us and learn a little bit more probably than we even know about each other. So jumping right in, let's talk about your journey starting into the Air Force and getting into some of the special operations that you've done.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. This is going to be rad, man. It's good to chop it up with you. So getting into Air Force pararescue at the time, I graduated high school 1995. So this is pre-internet. For me, I wasn't a very scholastic kid in high school. I was busy chasing other things other than doubling down on studies. And so for me, college wasn't really an option. And so I'm like, okay, well, what am I going to do next? What's next for me? And I considered going into the SEALs. I considered going into, I kind of looked at Army SF and the Rangers. My dad was a 101st Airborne paratrooper in Vietnam. And so he was adamantly against me going into the Army. And so it was kind of between the Navy and the Air Force. And one of my buddies who I went to high school with was going in the Air Force to be a heavy vehicle driver. So I went into the Air Force recruiter's office. He had a little pamphlet of what pararescue is. And so opened up the pamphlet. You got to jump out of planes. You got to practice medicine. You got to scuba dive, shoot guns, drive ATVs, rock climb, like everything an 18, like emerging 18 year old man would like want to do, like the adventure in a young man's life. And I'm like, okay, I want to do that. Sign me up for that. And man, just fast and furious off to the races.
So were you in physical shape at this point? And when was the, like, what was your, okay, you signed on the dotted line.
Yeah.
Like, you got to come in some kind of game shape, or were you?
Yeah, good question. So even though I went in 95, I signed up in 1994. And so again, pre-internet, the Air Force recruiter, I got recruited out of Bozeman, Montana. And so not a whole lot of kids are going into pararescue in Bozeman. And so the Air Force recruiter is like, well, let me dust this book off the shelf here. Open it up. He's like, we have to take this pass test. I've never done one before, but you have to run a mile, you have to swim a half mile, and you have to do some underwater stuff and some push-ups and pull-ups. So I was never a strong swimmer. And so I trained for the swim, and I barely made the swim time. And my calisthenics and everything was good enough to at least get me into
the program. Do you remember what the mile criteria was?
The half mile, or the mile criteria, I think it was like something around nine minutes for the mile. Yeah, so it wasn't terrible. But I had to train for it a little bit. I certainly wasn't a strong athlete in any shape, way, or form of the word.
Yeah, and so you go in. I mean, is it the typical stuff you see in the movies? Like they're yelling at you, head shaved. Your spit on their shoes.
Yeah.
Kind of deal.
So after basic training, Air Force basic was not, it was not challenging at all. It was more of like folding clothes, ironing shirts, studying books, a little bit of physical therapy, but more so of a gentleman's course. After basic training, you really get into pararescue selection, which is 10 weeks. It's 10 weeks of selection school. The first 4 weeks are, so each week compounds on each other. So each week it's incrementally more difficult.
And so you had your eye on the ball, your eye on the prize the whole time, right? Like you knew going in, like that was your intent. That's what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
And did you think about the consequences of not making selection?
I did. So we had our class, our balls class, they call it balls because it's 00 as a designator. So our balls class, we had 200 guys or so start in the Genesis, like week one. And then we had less than 10 graduate at the end of 10 weeks. So huge attrition rate.
Wow.
I remember there was grown men crying before going into the pool sessions. Guys would get injured, but the majority of guys just quit. They would mentally quit, and then they would just tap out and be gone. So to answer the question of keeping my eye on the prize, I just for what got me through the day was just no matter what happens, I told myself, no matter what happens today, I'm 18 years old, 145 pounds, like dripping wet, skinny kid. I what did I know? Right. I didn't know anything. I'm just like, whatever happens today, I'm not going to quit no matter what. And as the weeks progressed, I stayed there and other guys weren't.
And what do you think? I mean, I know you, but that's a special mindset, LeJon. Like, you know, I'm sure everyone went there with that same, I'm not going to quit.
Yeah.
What do you think was some of the driving force behind that? Because you had nothing to lose or because, you know, your dad was a military guy. You didn't want to like, had to be some drivers there. Was
it? So I think like really peeling back the layers and getting down to the root of it. We didn't have like 1995. There wasn't cell phones. This is like pre everything. So there was an analog payphone. I remember there was two payphones downstairs, and I couldn't fathom picking up the phone and telling my dad that I quit. I couldn't go and tell my dad that I quit. That was a driving force. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Father's disdain or your perceived.
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't.
I didn't want to let him down. And yeah. Whether it's a sense of pride in my own heart or just, bullheadedness, I couldn't go and tell him that, that I quit. You know, failing out is one thing, not making the standards is another thing, getting injured. Like those are all fine. But like saying that I actually quit, I couldn't do that to him in my own heart.
It's definitely a strong driver. I mean, I think it's a great motivator. It obviously served you well.
Yeah.
The fire was lit.
Yeah.
So take me through some of the more daunting things that you encountered. Like what were something like, some kind of obstacle or challenge that you personally were like, oh man, this one, like maybe some of them you had a high degree of confidence and you're like, I know I'm going to nail that, but this one scares the heck out of me. And how do you prepare for something like that?
Yeah. So the pool I think is what gets most guys, and just the mindset. There's a lot of, underwater breath holding exercises, long periods of time where you're not breathing and you have to perform fine motor skills under pressure. And so I understand what that training is for and why they're trying to weed out the program is established to weed out folks that don't have that mindset and don't quit. But, for sure it was always the water sessions, these big 13-foot pool. We'd have these ditch and dawn sessions where you have a scuba tank on and a weight belt on and a mask. And you have to go down and ditch your gear down at the bottom of the 13-foot pool. And so everything has to be laid out perfectly. Weight belt has to be on top of the scuba cylinders perfectly. Fins have to be under there. Mask has to be perfect. So that's like half of it. And then you come up for air. Sometimes the instructors take a breath from you. Sometimes they let you catch your breath. And then you got to go back down and dawn. So that's the ditch part of it. The dawn part of it is getting all the gear on, making sure everything is perfect, making sure there's no water in your mask, and then coming back up and getting inspected and getting the pass. That was probably like one of the most challenging things, like the bigger, big water confidence activities.
And that is not a heated pool.
It certainly didn't feel like it was heated in the way it was cold.
It was cold.
I mean, it might've been heated
maybe
a little bit.
Maybe not ice chips, but
yeah. You're not getting in. It's not in the 80s. It's certainly not a hot tub by any means.
No.
Yeah.
So there's the pool stuff. What about, high altitude, right? It's pararescue, right?
Yeah.
So you're jumping out of a plane.
That's right.
Was that more of the focus, but they wanted to do some of this? I mean, some of that sounds like that's like SEAL stuff, right?
So
criteria.
The water confidence is really the first 10 weeks of selection is to weed out. That's where 90% of the folks don't make it. And then you get after graduation from selection school, you're off into the pararescue pipeline. It's 2 years of learning the basic skill set to be a pararescueman. So static line airborne school, scuba school, for me, that was down in Key West. Send you to survival school. You spend 6 months or so learning how to be a paramedic. You go to basic airborne school. It's cool. My dad, he was a prior paratrooper in Vietnam. So when I graduated airborne school, he came in and pinned my wings on me, gave me some blood wings. Oh, it was rad. It was great. I was crying. It was like very, very emotional time. And then you go to free fall school, learn how to do all the HALO, HAHO operations, HALO being high altitude, low opening, HAHO being high altitude, high opening. And then after you graduate the pipeline, you're off to your unit and it's another 18 months or so until, guys are competent enough, to operate on their own.
Wow. Did you do some of the high altitude stuff, high altitude jumps? Is that?
Yeah. So high altitude. So we did Halo. I've got 500 jumps between.
Seriously.
Halo jumps and static line parachuting jumps. So a bunch of water jumps as well. A couple water rescue missions, which are sweet. But my back and neck are certainly hurting from that many parachute jumps.
Dude.
Yeah. What?
Did you dread one more than the other, whether it was the...
Oh, yeah. So I dreaded the static line parachute jumps. It's the old Army canopies. Now...
That's where you're like clipped in carrier style.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's called dope on a rope. So you're hooked into the static line, an aircraft, you're on a 13-foot static line, and you just follow the guy that's in front of you. You jump out, and the plane's going 130 knots, which is right around... 150 miles an hour and you're jumping out and static line hits and wham, and it whips you. It's not a pleasurable experience. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you have any scary spins or disorienting things happen? I mean, you had 500 jumps.
Yeah. No cutaways. I never deployed my reserve. I never cut away. There's guys that have cut away multiple times. Fortunately for me, I never did. Couple scary openings, a couple snivels, but nothing terrifying.
Rough landings.
I've had some rough landings, dude, for sure. Rough landings. The roughest landings are on, we're doing airfield seizures. So C-130 or whatever the drop aircraft is coming in at 800 feet. So 800 feet above the deck, it's really low.
It's low.
Nighttime, you're jumping out and you're landing on a runway. So think of like an actual like hard pack cement runway that's made to handle impacts of for aircraft. And so it's super hard landings. That was probably the hardest landings I've had are those.
Broken bones?
No broken bones, dude.
No ruptured discs? No.
Yeah, ruptured discs, yes. So I had cervical spine surgery in 2013, just from repeated injuries, flying around with MVGs on, with a helmet, counterweights on there, just the continual impact on the body. It's tough. And I don't know any PJ or SEAL or other SF guys that don't have like sustained long-term injuries from the job that we've done. It's just, it's hard on the body. Certainly a younger man's game.
Got it. And just asking a more, you know, layman's term question. So you guys, the pararescue, it is SF, and then it's its own SF. And then you're also in support of Rangers and SEALs and
that's right. Yeah. Yeah. So pararescue is its own, it's its own rescue force or personnel recovery force. So we will deploy as a pararescue package. That's either, we can operate autonomously. We can fly on helicopters. We can get infilled via, either MRAP or some sort of up armored vehicle. We can infill via Zodiac. So that's one portion of it, of it being its own self-contained rescue force. And then PJs are also attached to Navy units or Army units or Marine Corps units as a personnel recovery specialist.
Is it ever deployed as a fighting unit or force?
So not to my knowledge. We do not have a direct assault unit. Again, like it's a smaller portion of the special operations community, and we are personnel recovery specialists. So instead of like a direct assault force, we will attach our guys to a direct assault team as the personnel recovery person and combat trauma medic.
And that assault team, so this is like the joint operations.
JSOC guys JSOC. Will do that. Yep.
Okay. Yeah. And so what they say, hey, you're going to go in, they say you're going in with this SEAL team to do this. And
Yep, they sure can. So the guys will spin up with the Navy guys or the Army guys, spend some time pre-deployment, and then they'll deploy as a unit. And so our PJs will get to know the unit tactics. They'll train with them on whatever the team is doing, whether it's a direct action mission or reconnaissance mission or otherwise.
Okay, so forgive my history here. When you enlist, are we peacetime or are we in a combat situation?
Gosh, man, 95. It was, I think we were mainly peacetime.
Peacetime.
Yeah, we were mainly peacetime. The war, 9/11, right, is when things really started to kick off.
Yeah.
And guys started doing lots of pump outs to the desert, Iraq, Afghanistan.
So is that like halfway through your...
Gosh, man, no. So I retired out in 2014. So this is kind of early stages.
It's early. Okay. Stages,
yeah. So at that point, I'd gotten off of active duty. I did 2 years of training in the pipeline to become a PJ, and then 2 years in Florida at the 23rd Special Tactics Squadron. So during that time, I did a deployment to Kuwait, and then also in the Bosnia-Kosovo zone.
Wow.
In the late 90s, yeah. And then after that, I came back to the California Air National Guard, where I spent the majority of my time. Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, it was good, man. Kosovo is cool.
Can you give us a little snippet from one of your experiences there?
Oh, well, yeah. So we did, our teams, the PJ teams recovered two aircraft. I think there was an F-117 that got shot down and an F-14 that got shot down. So I was on the backup mission to both of those. So not the primary teams, but, there was one super scary incident we had, in the back of a MH-53 flying around at night, in the Balkans, and one of the engines, the right engine, caught on fire. So I'm a 5-level PJ, freezing my butt off in the back of this MH-53. It's pitch black. There's a tail gunner right there. I can see him on the 50 cal. And I think he's like lighting a cigarette and throwing cigarettes out. And you kind of hear this pop. I'm like, what the hell is that? And then the engine just like, boom, is on fire. The flames coming out this thing. So the pilots are diligently trying to shut this thing down. And we're in the back with a 10-person army team. Myself, another pararescueman, and a combat controller, and I was thinking, man, we're going to end up a smoking hulk on the side of a mountain in the middle of nowhere. And it was nighttime, freezing. I remember kind of auto rotating down, and then the pilot just pulling pitch. You could feel the pitch in the back of the helicopter as it like noses up like this, and I see the tail rotor go into the trees, and like the snow starts coming in the back of the 53. I'm like, okay, this is the moment of my death.
Oh, man.
This is, I'm going to die. And so I'm praying to God, like, please, like, save my soul, save this aircraft. And by God's grace, we like barely missed this cliff edge, and we're able to land in a little French compound, get out, pilots are shaking. It was an unreal experience. It was super heavy.
And is that a situation where you have to evade capture? Are you not in a hostile area at that time?
I think semi-hostile environment, certainly in the French controlled zone of Bosnia. So there might've been little skirmishes going on, but, for us, the hostility was this helicopter is going to smack in the side of a mountain.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was probably 20, 21 at the time, 21, 22. Yeah,
man.
Yeah.
So getting into some of the deployments, can you take us through some of the, you know, most memorable, most heaviest, or, and, you know, even most proud, where you really made an impact and maybe let's go there.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll give you two from my last deployment in Afghanistan, 2013. I was a team commander, so flying. I had a team of five PJs. We'd fly a two-ship H-60s outside of the wire every day into the South Helmand province, so true search and rescue and recovery, picking up men who were shot, guys who were blown up, kids who were shot and burned. We surprisingly picked up several POWs as well. And so two missions that stand out the most. One was an extended ground operation, rescue and recovery ground operation, where there was an army person who was trying to cross a kind of almost like a small aqueduct or river in Kandahar, so in the middle of Kandahar. And he had full kit, K-pod on, weapon, and he slipped and just went under the water. And the water is like super brown, really muddy. You couldn't see, like 6 inches under it, like gone. And so the army couldn't find his guy. So we came in with helicopters, had my team. We blew up two Zodiac boats, one Zodiac boat, like inflated it there. It was myself, pararescue team leader, who is running the ground operations, and then PJ on the other side of the bank, and two guys in the boat, and we're just bringing the boat back and forth, poking on the ground, trying to find. This army person, we found him. We found the body. were able to recover them, put him in a body bag, and then get him back front to the up armored vehicles, back to his base, and then package it back up and flew him back back to the airfield. And then his body was shipped back to the U.S. So that's very memorable. Another one from that time was the well mission. So our guys were flying we had the graveyard shift, so 1 a.m. to 1 p.m. And early morning, there was a Marine infantry unit on the ground, and they were doing early morning patrols, and their rear security guy, MVG's on, it's tough, like kind of right at the time where the sun's coming up and you don't have full loom, so he still had MVG's on. He fell into this open pit well.
Oh.
Super, super gnarly. Full kit. And dude, this
was
well,
this thing level to the ground, like
yeah, it's
level
on the ground, so you can't. It's not like there's no fence lines on. It's just a big pit in the middle of this field. So this guy's rear security. When you're on rear security, you're always looking behind you, so you're mainly checking the rear to make sure that the team above, like in front of you, is okay, because you're the rear security guy. So he's walking backwards, falls into this thing, full gear, full kit. Call comes in. Hey, there's a guy in a well. That's all. That's all we know. Like guy in a well, the Marine Corps infantry is putting out security around the perimeter. So we don't know we have no idea what we're going to see. So we ended up taking off, made the call that check the scene survey, check the threat levels. The pilot and I decided, yeah, this mission is a go. And we get on the scene, and we didn't know what to expect. So we had a high angle rope rescue kit, and this well was probably 80 feet, just deep, very deep well. And so we get on the deck. Marine Corps guys have security out. It's myself and four other PJs, and pararescue team leader does a phenomenal job kind of directing guys here and there. And we could like scream down at the bottom of this well. He's so deep, you could barely hear him. So he's still alive. Still alive.
Fell
80 feet into this thing.
How narrow is this well?
It's probably 7 or 8 feet wide. It's big. It's big. It's big. Like an animal would have fallen in this thing. So this guy's at the bottom of this thing. So PJs do they set a rope anchor around these mud huts, South Helmand Province. The huts are kind of, it's like a wooden structure with like bizarre insulation around it. So we set an anchor. We put a guy, Nathan Schmidt, on belay, lower him down in this well. He's a primary medic. He's got a bunch of ketamine on him, some other narcotics, loads this guy up, ends up packaging. He's got a little headlamp, packages him up, and then we just start hauling him up. So we set up a 3-to-1 rescue system, rescue rig, start hauling this guy back up, and he's screaming, like bloody murder,
yeah,
like because
yeah.
open femur fracture, broken tib fib.
Uh-huh.
We get him up on the deck, package it back up, give him some more meds, give him an IV bag, and then call the helicopters back in. You know, we pop smoke, helos come in, land, get him and the two primary medics on board, and we fly the trail helicopter back to Camp Bastion. Get him into higher surgical care. So by the time the call came in and by the time he was actually in the surgical room, was like an hour and a half. So our guys are like, it was awesome. It was like the penultimate PJ rescue of such a unique skill set and robust skill set and quick decision-making,
yeah,
proactive thinking, and really going into like an unknown zone.
Yeah, just everyone knowing their job, everyone trusting each other.
Yeah.
Working in full concert in unison.
100%.
Just clockwork.
It was awesome. It was awesome. It was such a like true like surgical operation, like the true rescue in every sense of the word. And so the guy that we pulled out is still alive today, and it's awesome.
Walking?
Yeah, walking, man, he recovered. Dude. Yeah, super gnarly. I mean, like, he would have been dead. He would have like bled out, and it was gnarly.
I mean, you hear battlefield stories, you see it on you know the big screen, and it's always shootouts and ambushes and that. You don't think about guys falling into an aqueduct, guys falling into a well, like these sort of battlefield logistical situations that are perhaps maybe even more common and more dangerous than the enemy.
Yeah.
Did you guys ever come under fire when you were trying to rescue anyone or even civilian?
No, not our last deployment to Afghanistan. Yeah. No active combat or active fire engagements. Yeah.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
But you are putting yourself at risk every time you leave the base. And
we're forward
operating bases.
Flying in a hostile zone, coming into a troops in contact call, flying to point of injury. So a couple times we have certainly pulled people out that were recently shot on the battlefield. We pulled one kid out. He had to be. This was a local Afghani kid, probably eight years old, through and through, gunshot of the abdomen. Mm. It was just the most the Afghani people. They are hard.
They're hardy.
Hard people. I mean, so this kid's dad was with him, somewhat emotionless, and the kid no medical treatment, no IVs, no barely even a Band-Aid on him, no pain meds, and just stoic. It was gnarly.
That's hard.
Super hard. Yeah.
Were you guys even thinking that kid's hard?
Oh, dude, I was. I didn't have kids at the time. And I was like, dude, this is looking back on it now and being a father now and how just so protective of our kids. And it's just it's such a different world.
Yeah. Did you ever have a moment where you really needed to rely on, you mentioned God earlier. I know you have faith where you had, some adversity. I know the story sounds like where you almost went into a cliff in the helicopter.
Yeah.
But just that you were able to call on God or call on your faith and how maybe that, I don't know, that adversity, did it strengthen your faith, or had you always had that as a foundation, or?
Yeah, so I kind of grew up in the faith a little bit. My parents were divorced when I was little, and then I followed loosely to Christian values and Christian faith kind of through high school, and then when I got into the pararescue teams, especially when I graduated, I was off to the races, living in the world, as they say, for almost a decade. And then was able to come back to my faith later in life, maybe around 28, 29 years old. And then the risks of the inherent risks of what we do is as pararescue men. I mean, even in training and in combat theaters, it had a new, very heavy weight, to it at the time, especially being in a leadership position. You think of the decisions that you make and the lives that I'm essentially responsible for, right? These men have families, they have children, and they're putting their life on the line, and trusting in themselves and then trusting in me as for the decision maker. So, without having a faith background, I don't know how I got through some of the early years and the early stages.
Yeah. When did it really kind of hit home with you, and when did you really get on board and start to dive in and really just sort of give yourself?
Probably 2008, 2009, I was really seeking. I was seeking so much. Being in the Bay Area, I was seeking new age spirituality. I looked into Buddhism. There was a bunch of other things. I went to Burning Man for a week, and I'm running around out in the desert.
I can't even picture that.
Oh, dude.
I can't.
Just it was crazy. Out in the desert for a week and just doing things at Burning Man. And so I knew that there was something more. I knew that there was something more than just this and being a PJ and leading programs and leading men and going on deployments. It was great, but I knew that there was something more. And so my dad had come back to his faith as a believer and as a Christian, and was really encouraging me to read the Bible. And so was like, okay, well, sure, why not? Let me just read this thing. So I bought it was like a study guide or a Bible that you could read cover to cover in a year. And I went through the entire Bible in like 6 months. And I feel like that's when the Holy Spirit just really got a hold of me and really started to like, okay, this is truth. And like reading, I remember, kind of my moments of conversion, like weeping in my car as I'm reading this, and just what caught me in it. And so 2008, 2009 is really very, very formative years of my life.
I mean, I hear that and I feel like, you know, reading the Bible, I kind of equate it sometimes to, you know, you can be on one side of the glass trying to, yeah. You're like knocking on the glass and
yeah.
How do I get to the other side? And it was clearly impactful for you. Obviously, yeah. I've since had breakthrough moments that perhaps I'll share in a different podcast or something.
Good.
But do you feel like, obviously that, you know, it must have been through, you must have been equating some of those literally life and death moments in the service. And then it just hit you, spoke to you at the right time. I mean, it's an amazing thing. But it doesn't sound like you had, you prayed to God. It sounds like probably on a few occasions, but that wasn't really when you were rooted in the faith at that point.
I mean, admittedly, every jump, every mission, I'd always say a quiet prayer, like, Lord, like if something happens, just take me home. Even though I certainly wasn't living by in obedience by any way, shape or form, but every jump, every flight, every time I stepped on a helicopter, every time I stepped on a plane, it was just watch out for me.
Do you have any like adrenaline, like, do you yearn to jump out of a plane again? Or are you just like, no, I'm glad that chapter's done and I'm done.
I've done a bunch of birdmen. I mean, every once in a while, my brother's still an active duty PJ and he'll tell me stories about jumping and all the fun things he's doing. And so, I don't think so.
No.
I don't think so, man. I think, that chapter is done.
You're
and
good.
Closed. I mean, unless like, I don't think so. I don't know. It'd have to be like a very special event just because I think, I feel like all I dreamed of as a little kid was doing military stuff. I've got a picture when I was probably 10 years old of me with a parachute and my face camo's on. And I've got a weapon and like, it's exactly like I have pictures of me as a grown man doing pararescue stuff with like that exact thing. So I feel like I lived my dream as a kid. And then that door is likely closed. I mean, I got neck issues and back issues and just like the risk to my family. And like, I've got kids now and I have the most respect and I just like the sacrifice of guys that are married and have children and do the job, men and women in the armed forces. It's truly remarkable what they risk. And
yeah. And so, yeah. And thankfully you're out, you're all in, you've got all your facilities and limbs and yes.
Yeah. By God's grace, man. Come
on. Some bumps and bruises. But, so then you get out and you go into law school straight away.
So I got out, went to law school. We're trying to figure out which path and which direction to go. My wife has two uncles who are attorneys. One's a family practice guy and one's a trust and estate planning attorney. So put a lot of time and a lot of effort, focus, prayer time into what we were going to do next and decided that law was the right pathway. So I started for the bar. I got accepted and then took three years of law school and then I practiced for 4 years post law school.
And what kind of law were you practicing there?
Yeah. So, basic litigation, some family practice, some trust and estate planning. I had my own law firm for a year or so. And then I was also a prosecuting attorney at Ada County for almost a year.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Okay.
I was a terrible prosecutor. Just in the fact that like, I couldn't see criminalizing kids for having a vape pen or smoking weed or whatever. Just like kids being stupid kids. I'd always give them a second chance. And I thought that was the right thing to do.
Yeah. And now that, so that career was sort of short lived. Didn't sound like you loved that too much.
I didn't. I like leading people. I like being a part of a team. And just the law, of, I don't know, I couldn't see myself doing it for the next 20 years or so. So I made a pivot, into sales. Actually for a short time there, I sold medical devices in Dallas, Texas. And, that's how I met my wife. She was a Cordis endovascular rep up in Seattle. I was a Cordis endovascular rep in Los Angeles, and we met in Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh, that's awesome.
It was rad.
And you had four kids,
man. 10-year-old boy, 8-year-old girl, 6-year-old boy, and 4-year-old girl. It's awesome. God's grace, man.
Yeah. I mean, so what would... If you had the magic wand, I mean, you've lived lives already, right? Yeah. You've done more living than most people that are already past retirement age. Oh. You've achieved a lot. I know in passing, you're like an onion. Every time I talk to you, I learn a little something new. I believe you had mentioned you had ran from the Bay Area to LA or something. Yeah. Hundreds of miles.
Yeah, my buddy Mike and I, we ran to raise awareness for the Black AIDS Foundation. So we started north of the Golden Gate Bridge and ran all along Highway 1. So 14 days, we averaged a marathon a day for 14 days all the way down PCH and then ended up in the Nike store in Los Angeles. It was awesome.
Yeah, that's rad. Again, that's another, you know, I've got some experience with marathons, but, you know, and I've ran several, but not...
Yeah.
Back to back for that kind of duration, that is some serious pounding and abuse.
Yeah, the thing I said again out of that to myself was like, I'm just not going to quit today. I'm going to get up and just start moving.
Yeah. I mean, is there other things that motivate you to achieve, or do you feel like it is enough, you are enough, or do you feel like, okay, I've been eyeballing this little bucket list thing. Yeah. And that can be, it could be spiritual, it could be mental, it could be whatever, financial, it could be, you know, I want to climb to the mountaintop of corporation. Like, what are your drivers now?
Yeah. Oh man, that's, my drivers now are to be present with my family, to be present as a husband, and to... be there for my kids into my 70s. So, just having the mindset of this is it's a long game with my family, and that really personal achievements, things like that. I want to bring my family along now in the adventure, my wife and kids along in the adventure. And we have a bunch of bucket list things. Certainly as my boys and girls start to come of age, we're going to have certain ceremonies and things that they do as well to usher them into adulthood. One of the main drivers is just being obedient to the word and following God.
Wow, that's a beautiful answer.
It's good.
And it's really powerful. And I think as dads, we do lose sight of our immediates, the family, the things that we care about the most because we want to provide for them and that's in our nature. And so we feel like we need to go do this so we can have this kind of house and they can go to this kind of college. And, but I think, you know, as someone, I've got three kids and I've got two practically driving and almost, out of the house and yours are a bit younger and, you know, it does go by fast. And, you know, fortunately for me in my situation was able to also kind of do what you're suggesting and, you know, having sold the business, and the driver wasn't necessarily moving forward financial for me. It was really about being there and like helping raise these kids.
Yeah.
You mentioned some of these ceremonies for, what does that mean?
Oh, so
what are those markers?
Yeah. Coming of age. We're moving target, but some sort of physical feat where it takes, effort, where it takes mindset, where it takes some skill. Certainly for our boys, maybe around 14 or 15 years old, where we're ushering them from boyhood into adolescence and young adulthood, where men who have been part of our boys' lives are pouring into them. And I mean, it could be where they go out and they do a point-to-point hike where they're out in the woods for like a sustained amount of time.
Dude, this is like some Spartan stuff.
There's got to be some risk. Yeah, there's got to be some risk there. There's got to be an element of like danger of like, you know, not where it's like negligent. I'm not going to put them in like some terrible situation, but they're going to have to work and do some things, and it's probably going to be scary. And like it's a big deal, where I think some other cultures get it right. We're going to institute that in our own family and have like a ceremony about it.
Yeah.
And, almost like a knighthood, and present them with some token of like, there's like, okay, you are now moving into manhood. You're leaving your boyhood behind you. You're moving into manhood. This is a new phase of your life. This is what is expected of you. These are the men that have come before you.
Man, I think that's so cool. Because it speaks to you are enough. You have what it takes.
That's right.
Right. And I think there are those, you're doing it sort of via a ceremony, but you know, I think there are very few opportunities for boys to get validated into men.
That's right.
Especially now. So the fact that you're turning it into sort of this ceremonial thing is really cool. And I love that. And I may take that.
Come on, man. Let's do it. I'd love to ideate with you about what that looks like.
I love it.
And I think it's very powerful to have other men speak into our boys' life.
Yeah.
You know, as they become older.
What would you say? So you've got, you know, the military lineage that you have, if your boys were like, "Hey, pops,
oh,
I want to go." Like, what is that? How does that grab you? I'm getting a vibe right now.
Yeah. Just knowing, I mean, ultimately I have to trust that these are truly God's children and he has them no matter what.
Mm, okay.
With that, you know, I feel like, I would tell them like I've served and I've done our duty so that you don't have to unless you truly feel led to go and do something in the service. And so, I mean, I would it'd be a tough one for me. That'd be tough. I'd be so proud of them. It like at one point, and then just the risk, and like that's like next level. But I don't know, man.
yeah. No, I get it.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we covered some ground today. I could talk to you for hours. You're a super interesting guy. I love the place where you come from. There's so much heart involved there's so much heart and head with where you come from. And I hope that those of you that are watching and listening today, you know, picked up on some, you do have there's a calmness and a settled way over you. And it's kind of remarkable, frankly, because I don't know, maybe just because of your journey and you've seen so much and you have so much sort of life experience that you're able to take a step back and there's no proving to be done. There's no bravado. Yeah. You can kind of just.
I still, thank you for saying that. There's still times where I feel, you know, unworthy or that I'm not enough or that, that there's like some imposter syndrome, but I know that that's a lie. Yeah. I know that's a lie from the enemy, and that is like the enemy is always there attacking us where we're weakest. So, thank you for saying that.
Well, LeJean, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah.
And I, you know, the cool thing is we get to put these mics away. And we're buddies and we're going to hang out. And this isn't just a single service guest type of thing.
For sure. It's been, it's rad.
So thank you for being here. Thank you for sharing your story. Yeah. It's a great story. And thank you for your service.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you. You're welcome. You're welcome. Looking forward to many more conversations where we don't have the mic in front of us for sure.
All right, brother.
All right, man.
Thanks.
Thank you.